It's election season here in the Isle of Man, meaning politicians have to be well informed about the issues that matter most to the public, must have that common touch the electorate can resonate with, and above all else, it's important for them to be on their best behaviour. The media also has a vital role to play in conveying the messages of those standing for public office, scrutinising their flagship policies and holding them to account for their actions. The pressure of the situation can make or break a candidate. Some rise to the occasion and bat away the tough questions with apparent ease. Others crumble, are often ridiculed, and their campaign teams are left to pick up the pieces. This programme will take a light-hearted look at some of the more famous political gaffes of recent times. Welcome to the Political Blunderbox.
We believe it'll be about £300,000.
£300,000?
Sorry,
10,000 police officers? What are you paying them?
Teresa's a bloody difficult woman.
Am I tough enough? Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Now, when a general election looms, the focus is naturally on serious subjects. However, this programme will explore some of the more amusing clips that have featured on TV and radio over the last 10 years or so. I'll point out at this stage as well, we'll be looking at incidents involving politicians across the water. We had considered including a few comical hiccups a bit closer to home. However, as some of those feature candidates standing for keys in September, we want to make extra care not to do anything which could be seen to unduly influence the outcome of anyone's campaign. Who knows, though? Perhaps there will be a Keys Blunderbox edition on its way in the future. We'll see how this one goes first. The following clips are from across the political spectrum and have been in no way picked because of anyone's own personal political persuasion. And here in the studio to chat through these gaffes is a heavyweight political interviewer, someone who's covered countless elections over the years and interviewed the candidates involved.
When's he arriving?
It's Manx Radio's John Moss, and it's a real privilege to be able to cover this with you. And I think hopefully it will serve as an advert for election coverage, because you just never know when politicians are going to drop the ball, do you, John?
It's a difficult thing. When you're a politician, you're coming in from another existence, basically, and suddenly everything you do is scrutinised, looked at, talked about, etc., etc. And you've got to think in plausible sentences and not promise things that you can't deliver. Under-delivery is probably better than over-promising, as they say.
Do you think we hold politicians and political candidates sometimes to unfairly high standards?
No, they get paid quite a good salary. I mean, one problem I have is when they actually take their seat, really, it's like if you take a job, you should be expected, you're being paid the salary from that moment, you should be expected really to start running from there and be able to pick up the torch and go with it. Occasionally you get the message coming through, he's only recently in so-and-so, so give it a few months, etc., before you talk to him or he or her, etc. But really, I think they should be prepared to go from the word go.
Well, I'm sure there are plenty who agree with that notion out there, as we'll find out over the next 20 minutes, though. All those in the public eye are human, and as humans, they're prone to errors. The first clip we're looking at here, then, is from a 2015 interview involving the then leader of the opposition locking horns with a notorious interviewer in Jeremy Paxman. Known for his intimidating and no-nonsense style, he had a huge reputation and was surely someone who would strike fear into a number of ministers and political candidates. They had to know their stuff, and you know, he rarely put up with bluster or waffle or not actually answering the question. Quite a daunting prospect for any politician.
Is this the 14 questions, is it? Why? What was it?
This isn't that, no.
Isn't it? Because on that occasion, he apparently ran out of questions to ask, and he was thinking, what do I ask next? And because the opportunity was offered, he just asked the question again and then again and again. And after a while, because it was good sport, he continued doing it. And of course, it's gone down in interview history after that.
I have gone for a slightly different one. This is with Ed Miliband, who was then leader of the Labour Party. And in this clip, it kind of sounds like Jeremy Paxman is almost goading him or luring him into saying something which he knew would be a little soundbite and get people talking? Is that something you, as a journalist, John, when you're interviewing a political candidate, is at the back of your mind?
Well, this is the area of leading questions. Some people ask leading questions. If you don't know what a leading question is, it's if you say to someone, do you not think it would be better if you did this or did that or something? And the person could just say yes. The trick of being a journalist or being a presenter is to actually, if you want the person to say that, get them to say it, put into their minds, what would you say as regards this? Get them to say it. And then basically it's not your opinion that's coming over, as in a leading question, it's theirs. What you're trying to do is to get them to say it all the time and not yourself. If you are saying it yourself, then you've lost your disinterested status, which all journalists should have. Disinterested means that they can't work out whether you're coming from one direction or another. Basically, you're asking the right questions. You'd lose that status, and that is fatal, I think, for a presenter, for a journalist.
Well, this is what happened when Ed Miliband went head-to-head with Jeremy Paxman.
You know what people say about you because it's hurtful, but you can't be immune to it. A bloke on the tube said to me last week, Ed Miliband goes into a room with Vladimir Putin, the door is closed, 2 minutes later the door is opened again and Vladimir Putin is standing there smiling and Ed Miliband is all over the floor in pieces.
Was that David Cameron who you met on the tube?
No, it wasn't. I don't think he uses the tube very much. But
that's rather unfair to him, I think.
It is unfair.
Yeah.
But you understand what the point is here. The point is people think you're just not tough enough.
Well, let me tell you, right? Let me tell you, okay. Let me tell you, okay. In the summer of 2013, this government proposed action in Syria, the bombing of Syria, right? Mm. I was called into a room by David Cameron and Nick Clegg because President Obama had been on the phone, the leader of the free world, right? I listened to what they said, and over those days, I made up my mind, and we said no, right? Now, I think standing up to the leader of the free world. I think shows a certain toughness, I would say.
Are you proud of what's happened in Syria since?
I'm not proud of it, no. It's a failure of the international community. But what I'm not going to do is repeat the mistakes of the 2003 Iraq War, which happened when Labour was in power, which is a rush to war without knowing what your strategy is and without being clear about what the consequences would be. I'm not a pacifist, so I did support action in Libya, and David Cameron talked about how I supported action against ISIS. But am I tough enough? Tough enough? Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Possibly a bit harsh to label this a blunder, but if you are going to lean forward and claim that you are this tough political presence, you can't fluff your lines, can you, John?
Well, I think the phrase that was used by the American president, speak softly and carry a big stick, basically comes into thing. You can't bluster. You can't make yourself out. It's not like two heavyweights standing up before a contest and sort of eyeing each other down. If you do that, you're probably going to look ridiculous in the long run. So what you need to do is to hint that there's steel in there, to speak in such a way that people think, oh, there's something to this person behind it, and not actually coming out and say, beating your chest like Guy the Gorilla. Just making people aware of the fact that down there you do have a steel core.
And I hope if those who are listening to this at home, you could hear in that clip, even though you couldn't see it, you could hear when he leaned forward and the audience kind of chuckled a bit. They didn't believe that he was this tough figure who could go and sort out foreign crises and be the diplomat that I imagine voters in Britain would want as a global player. And I think Paxman was kind of playing on that, and he knew when he went into his big long story about him going into a room with Vladimir Putin, it was, I mean, you're not always fortunate to get enough airtime to be able to elaborate with questions, are you, John? So this was really him hearing anecdotes on the street and taking what was said about Ed Miliband being a weak figure and really being able to use that to get a soundbite and get a reaction.
You wonder
from Ed
really
Miliband.
Whether he did hear this anecdote on the street or whether he just produced it. I mean, you can produce certain things in interviews to make your point, etc., and to try and see if the person will rise to the bait. I still hold that in this case, Ed Miliband should have actually said, well, people will make up their own minds if by my actions.
Well, I guess we'll never know about that. That was one of the softer examples of getting it a bit wrong, just mixing up his words a bit. Let's delve into some more severe blunders then, episodes that have left those seeking power red-faced and looking for a hole in the ground to leap into. John, how important is it for politicians or candidates standing in elections to always be wary that there might be a microphone on?
This is the back of the car, isn't it, with Gordon Brown? You can understand he's been on the trail. He is fighting a hard election. He knows that he's up against it. He's probably very tired. And put a microphone on him or put a microphone in his vicinity. And he gets in the back of the car, which is a safe area, he thinks, and starts sounding off about what he really thinks, etc., forgetting that this was being broadcast.
And he's not very happy. And he says in this clip that it was a private conversation. But if he is wanting to be elected to public office, to the office of Prime Minister, then surely you have to be honest with voters. And if that's what he thought, that she was a bigot because she had those views, then...
Yeah, you have to be fair here. A lot of politicians, obviously, they don't come out and tell you everything they think. Some of the things are for consumption of the public, etc. The private things are better kept private, etc. I mean, you and I know that we've got microphones in front of us. I was taught early on in this job that never say anything next to a microphone, even if it's unplugged, that you wouldn't want to hear again repeated later on. You see some politicians basically talking about things when there's a microphone about, thinking you should watch that. There's a microphone there and you don't know if it's switched on or off. In this case, Gordon Brown was careless, and one of his aides should have actually alerted him straight away, saying, you put your index finger across your throat, which means basically be quiet, shut up. They should have done that much quicker.
Well, I think he actually blames one of the aides. But it's pure savagery, isn't it? The way this particular clip that you will hear, where he was actually in a BBC studio and they played the clip back to him.
Have you seen the picture of him?
With the head in his hands.
Yeah, that picture of him. He buries his face in his hands as he hears it. He obviously knows this is the end of my particular election. This is it, the end, that coming out. And unfortunately, although it is very sad and savage, etc., it was great radio and it was very well done by the presenter. I think it was, I forget who the presenter was.
It was Jeremy Vine. Let's roll the clip.
A microphone picked you up saying that was a very bigoted woman. Is that what you said?
I apologise if I've said anything like that. What I think she was raising with me was an issue about immigration and saying that there were too many people from Eastern Europe in the country. And I do apologise if I've said anything that has been hurtful, and I will apologise to her personally.
Someone has just handed me the tape. Let's play it and see if we can hear it.
She never put me with that woman. Whose idea was that?
I don't know. I didn't see her.
That's Sue, I think. It's just ridiculous.
They'll go with that one.
They will go with it.
What did she say?
Oh, everything. She's just a sort of bigoted woman. Said she used to be a lady. I mean, it's
That is what you said. She not allowed to express her view to you?
Of course she's allowed to express her view, and I was saying that. The problem was that I was dealing with a question that she raised about immigration, and I wasn't given a chance to answer it because we had a whole melee of press around her. But of course I apologise if I've said anything that has been offensive, and I would never put myself in a position where I would want to say anything like that about a woman I met. It was a question about immigration that really, I think, was annoying.
And you're blaming a member of your staff there, Sue?
No, I'm blaming myself, and I blame myself for what is done. But you've got to remember that this was me being helpful to the broadcasters with my microphone on, rushing into the car because I had to get to another appointment, and they have chosen to play my private conversation with the person who was in the car with me. I know these things can happen. I apologise profusely to the lady concerned. I don't think she is that. I think it was just the view that she expressed that I was worried about that I couldn't respond to.
I mean, that he knew, as you said before we played that clip, John, that was pretty much the end of his hopes, really, of being elected as the Prime Minister.
He was in a weak position anyway, because he knew that he was on shaky ground in the election anyway. If he'd been in a really strong position, I mean, decades before, say, if Churchill had made some remark like that, I think everyone would probably have had a guffaw, etc., and would have not taken it so seriously. But these days, anything that the media can leap upon, blow up, put on their front pages, can be deadly for your ambitions and hopes as a politician.
And another example of that is Ken Clark, the Conservative politician. This was before members elected and voted in Theresa May as the new Prime Minister following the Brexit vote. And he was just about to do an interview for Sky News, and he was having a chat with somebody he knows quite well.
It's about a fiasco.
I don't mind who wins as long as Gove becomes third.
As
long as Gove is not in the final two, I don't mind what happens.
I don't think the membership will vote for Gove.
No, they don't.
I remember being in a discussion once about something we should do in somewhere like Syria or Iraq, and he was so wild that I remember exchanging looks with Liam Fox, who's quite a much more right-wing than me, we exchanged views, and Liam was raising eyebrows. I mean, I think with Michael as Prime Minister, we'd go to war with at least three countries at once. He did us all a favour by getting rid of Boris, who just... the idea of Boris as Prime Minister is ridiculous.
And that could have happened.
I don't think either Andrea Leadsom or Boris Johnson actually in favour of leaving the European Union.
Well, I don't think they cared very much either way.
No, it was the obvious thing that the voters, i.e. Conservative Party members, were going to vote leave.
I don't know.
She's not one of the minus tiny band of lunatics
who
think we can have a sort of glorious economic future outside the single market. So long as she understands that she's not to deliver on some of the extremely stupid things she's been saying. Theresa's a bloody difficult woman, but you and I work for Margaret Thatcher.
You were wincing when you were listening to that, John. I mean, that is bread and butter, isn't it? The interview hadn't even taken place yet, and you've already got a story because of something that an experienced politician, let's not forget, has said on mic, not realising that it was recording.
Yeah, where the microphone was being held, because it was quite a good recording as well. I don't know if you watched The West Wing at all, but that actually was quite a good demonstration in there on one instance in which the president says something is thought to be off microphone, and it goes out and it causes an enormous stir. But in the end, it turns out to be quite advantageous to the president. And at the end, the question is put, did you do that on purpose? Did you really put that out seemingly as off mic, and when really you wanted that to have an audience? And he doesn't say anything. And it's obvious he did. So some politicians are quite good at actually making out that they didn't know they were being recorded. And then turning out, Michael Gove, incidentally, is back in the news after his wild nightclub antics in the last few days. He's now been earmarked for a position, I think, somewhere. But anyway, yes, he was waving his arms about, etc. But that was quite interesting. But surely Clark must have realised that there must be a chance that this was being recorded, what he was saying. You wonder whether he was saying it on purpose.
Perhaps as well. We know that politics is a cutthroat business and that there will always be people aiming to get higher and climb that ladder, and name dropping, full names as well. I mean,
yeah, that's why it makes you... He's going into the full rigmarole. He's going through the whole gamut there. And you're wondering, does he really know he's being recorded or not? I don't know. I remember interviewing Kenneth Clark in the studio we're sitting in at the moment, I remember, and we didn't have air conditioning in those days. I was talking to him at the same time, conscious as his drips of sweat were coming down and dripping off his nose, and that was rather taking my mind off the interview at the time, which was unfortunate. But no, Kenneth Clark, he said, I've served with Thatcher, he's sufficiently experienced a politician, surely to know that when an interview sounds as if it's going into the area which could be played as an interview, even though it doesn't look as if it's one at the time.
And Theresa May actually ended up adopting that bloody difficult woman tag as a badge of honour. That was easy for journalists to write up there, because it's as if Kenneth Clark doesn't know that he's being recorded. Diane Abbott in this clip does know she's being recorded. This is a live interview on LBC with Nick Ferrari, and it just goes to show you must be up to date and well abreast of the figures.
So how much would 10,000 police officers cost?
Well, if we recruit the 10,000 police men and women over a four-year period, we believe it'll be about £300,000.
£300,000?
Sorry,
10,000 police officers? What are you paying them?
No, I mean, sorry.
How much will they cost?
They will cost... It will cost... About £80 million.
About £80 million?
Yeah.
Right. How do you get to that figure?
We get to that figure because we anticipate recruiting 25,000 police, extra police officers a year at least, over a period of 4 years. And we're looking at both what average police wages are generally, but also specifically police wages in London.
And this will be funded by the reversing, in some instances, I think, the cuts to capital gains tax. But I'm right in saying that since Jeremy Corbyn became leader of the party, that money has also been promised to reverse spending cuts in education, spending cuts in arts, spending cuts in sports. The Conservatives would say you spent this money already, Diane Abbott.
Well, the Conservatives would say that. We've not promised the money to any area. We've just pointed out that the cuts in capital gains tax will cost the taxpayer over £2 billion, and there are better ways of spending that money. But as we roll out our manifesto process, we are specifically saying how we will fund specific proposals. And this morning I'm saying to you that we will fund the 10,000 extra police officers by using some, not all, but just some, of the over £2 billion.
The 80 million is the figure we
use. Yeah,
used.
Yeah.
But if you, I don't understand. If you divide 80 million by 10,000, you get 8,000. Is that what you're going to pay these policemen and women?
No, we're talking about a process over 4 years.
I don't understand. What is he or she getting? 80 million divided by 10,000 equals 8,000. So what are these police officers going to be paid?
We will be paying them the average...
Has this been thought through?
Of course it's been thought through.
Where are the figures?
The figures are that the additional cost in year one, when we anticipate recruiting 200 and about 250,000 policemen, will be 64.3 million.
250,000 policemen?
And women.
So you're getting more than 10,000. You're recruiting 250,000.
No, we are recruiting 2,000 and perhaps 250. And the cost.
So where did 250,000 come from?
I think you said that, not me.
No, you. I can assure you, you said that because I wrote it down.
What I'm saying about the costs is in year one, obviously, we're getting ready to recruit.
Right.
But in year two, the cost will be 64.3 million. In year three, the cost will be 139.1 million.
Right.
Year four, the cost will be 217 million. And year five, the cost will be 298 million. And that can be amply covered by reversing the cuts in capital gains tax.
So many things I love about that clip, John.
Well, it gets in the area of yes, Minister, doesn't it? And you wonder why she didn't have a list in front of her supplied by her officers with a few facts and figures there, or at an early stage of that conversation say, I haven't got the exact figures with you at the moment, but obviously, etc.
But
as it was, it went on and got worse and worse.
It's the rustling of the papers as she's looking to try and find that figure. It's Nick Ferrari knowing that she's got the sums wrong. She's probably missed a zero somewhere. How on the ball and alert do you have to be as a journalist on air when you're doing live programmes, just in case this sort of thing does happen?
Well, all the time. You can't just relax. Occasionally, you are at fault at actually looking ahead to the next question and your mind goes on to the next question. But during the time that you're thinking of that next question, of course, something might happen in the last answer which needs picking up on. And it's only when you look back on it, you think, why didn't I pick that up? You have to concentrate all the time. It's why it's quite useful before you sit down for an interview, know roughly which areas you're going to in your mind, so you've got them locked in there, and then you can concentrate on the answers, which basically is what the important bit of the interview is.
The bit where Diane Abbott says, I think it was you who said 250,000 or whatever it is, does raise a smile as well. She was in a right pickle there, and Nick Ferrari, the host, would have, I'm sure, been incredibly proud at reducing a politician to a bumbling mess. Unfortunately, that's us out of time. Thanks to John Moss for his input, and I hope that's a lesson for us all. Election coverage can produce some absolute gems, so it is well worth watching and listening to. And for candidates standing in September, be wary that microphones might always be live, and it's always handy to be fully aware of what you're talking about.